This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
If you'd like to listen to our podcasts without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, enhanced show notes for select shows, and more. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or the first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code ECLIPSE to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code ECLIPSE. Thank you very much for your support.
Hi, this is Riley Fessler, producer for the DSR Network. Today's episode from the archive is a conversation between Rosa Brooks, Corey Shockey, and Ed Luce on what would happen to U.S. foreign policy if Donald Trump were elected to a second term. We hope you enjoy.
Nine. 12. 10. 28. 2. 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super-secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello, and welcome to the latest DSR podcast. I'm your host, David Rothkopf, joining you from beautiful, sunny, spring-like Washington, D.C. Also here at beautiful, sunny, spring-like Washington, D.C., we have the fabulous Rosa Brooks of Georgetown University Law School. How are you doing, Rosa?
I'm very well, David. Thank you.
You seem very muted for such a lovely day.
But I'm sorry. I'm terrific. Thank you, David.
Excellent. Now, that's the kind of insincerity we look for on this show. Let's try it here with Ed. Of course, you can never tell with the British, but also joining us, Ed Luce of the Financial Times here in glamorous Washington. How are you, Ed?
Enchanted, I'm sure.
Jesus.
Very nicely done, Ed.
Very nicely done. Have you watched The Diplomat?
I sort of gave up halfway through the first episode because I just so couldn't imagine a chargé, you know, running the world quite in that fashion.
It was so stupid. Have you watched it, Rosa?
No, but I read three quarters of Fred Kaplan's review of it in Slate, so I feel almost as if I watched
it. Yeah, I tried to watch
it. And it was a lot, took me a lot less time to read Fred's review than to watch it.
Yeah, well, it took me not much time to watch, because I turned it on and it was like, well, I'm getting ready to go to be the ambassador in Kabul. And I thought, well, we don't have an embassy in Kabul. And then she goes to the White House and the president says, I've made you ambassador to England. You leave to, or the UK, you leave tonight. And she goes, what? And I was like, what about getting confirmed? And then they fly her over on a private jet, which doesn't happen with ambassadors. And then she meets her DCM, who the White House chief of staff has been on the phone with, on a screen that says White House chief of staff. And she's like, we're sizing her up for vice president. So give her a good look. You're a kingmaker.
I've been waiting for the president to call me and just say, I'm making you ambassador to the United Kingdom. I need you to get on a private plane tomorrow morning.
And I was like, okay. And so I turned it off. And then when I posted this on Twitter that I turned it off, people said, well, I got a little further. I stopped right when her husband had to smell her armpits. There was apparently
I got up to that point. In fact, I got up to that point, and then, yeah, no, it's not just her armpits. Yeah.
Why are you doing that? Oh, I don't want to know. Okay.
Oh, my God.
That's what the life of diplomacy is like.
Is that?
You want to be a high flyer in the life of diplomacy. You're always having, you know that scene in The Fish Called Wanda?
Yeah.
Do you remember that scene? It's like that.
Diplomacy is a lot more like A Fish Called Wanda than it is like The Diplomat. Let me leave it at that.
I would agree with you.
Yeah.
It's made House of Cards look like a documentary.
That is the truth. Either version of
it's too
version.
Bad. Life is not like TV because, you know, any second now the phone could ring for any of us and we would be told we've been eyeing you for vice president. You know, Kamala's stepping down and we need you to take her place. And we'll say, well, I'm a little busy this week, but if you insist.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking of all the great depictions of Washington and movies, because I wrote this article yesterday on Biden and his age, and I said, you know, he's old, so he's not going to be like Harrison Ford when he fought off the terrorists in Air Force One, or Jamie Foxx when he fought off the terrorists in White House Down. And I was thinking, think how often presidents have to fight off terrorists
constantly
in Hollywood movies, you know?
Yeah. Constantly. I mean, right here as a professor at Georgetown Law, I fight them off two or three times a week.
Well, you know who fights terrorists all the time? Corey Shockey of the American Enterprise Institute.
Yes.
I hope I am better at fighting terrorists than I am at getting the link for Deep State Radio to work.
That's okay. No one had to know. We were just talking about how bad The Diplomat was, and then we're talking about the general depiction of Washington in movies, you know.
Ah, ghastly. One of the worst is Madam Secretary, which is so visibly recorded in New York City, not in Washington.
Yeah. No, it's much more realistic in that Charlize Theron movie where she's the Secretary of State, and then she falls for her ex-high school friend Seth Rogen, her speechwriter, and then, you know, they get married and she becomes president.
Yes, I agree. Also, what is it with movies made by these great young male comedians who manage to land women so far out of their actual price?
Actual league.
Yeah, no, the Seth Rogen with Charlize Theron, is that what you were saying? Yeah, that's a kind of Hollywood tradition. I could discuss this the whole time. It's a subject that is endlessly fascinating to me. But let's talk a little bit about the real world. And I'll just start with a couple of the news items from today and get your reaction to them. Let me start with you, Ed. Xi Jinping had a conversation with Vladimir Zelensky in which apparently he, you know, tried to connect and listen, also said nuclear war is a bad thing. Some people said, oh, it's terrible he said that. That means he was threatening Zelensky. Other people said, oh, it's good he said that. He's against nuclear war. What was your reaction, Ed?
I was very pleased by the fact that it happened. You know, I guess we're going to get overinterpretation of very limited summaries from both sides of those calls. But, you know, Zelensky has been all along very, very careful not to criticize China because he clearly has, he would have grounds to criticize China for, you know, assisting Russia and getting around some of the sanctions and with its oil revenues. But he clearly foresees a time where China can be a useful, play some kind of useful role in bringing Putin to the negotiating table and a settlement that could be favorable to Ukraine. And I think that that's obvious. It's very hard to think, of which other power could restrain Russia than China, of which is a vassal state. So, you know, regardless of what the content of the call was, the fact that it happened is good. I don't imagine if China does really want to get into some form of brokering an end to this war, that Xi Jinping could imagine now would be a good time. It's about the worst possible time. The Ukrainians are not going to want to think about it till they've seen how their offensive goes. And the Russians are not going to want to think about it until their humiliation ends, which might be never. So China is going to be important at some stage in the future. And I'm glad that this kind of dialogue has been opened.
You know, we make fun of how Hollywood distorts the lens and how the entertainment community distorts the lens of politics. And then I think, well, this was a phone call between a former comedian and TV sitcom star and a guy who for most of his life in China was less famous than his wife, who was a singer. So, you know, showbiz rules everywhere, Rosa. I just thought you would probably point that out, but you might have other reactions to this.
Right. Maybe somebody could make a Hollywood movie based on this, and the people involved could star as themselves.
Nice idea.
Nobody goes to that.
Zelensky's sitcom is pretty good, actually.
I have noticed that events don't occur as speedily in real life as they do on screen. I mean, this war is just, you know, taking forever, right? I mean, it would be over in a couple of episodes if this were a movie.
And by the way, everybody listening thinks the war's been going on for a year and a half, and it's actually been going on for 9.5 years.
Right.
So it's slower even than that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I shared Ed's sense of this is a good thing. And perhaps the call came in response to, was it only last week, the little oopsie doopsie, all the little Baltic countries aren't real countries. Oops, just kidding. And that was embarrassing for China, obviously.
Well, actually, statement by the Chinese ambassador to France was, any of the former Soviet countries aren't real countries, right? So
Right, exactly. I mean, but it was actually, if it was in response to that, that's actually not a bad thing, right? I mean, it's a good thing if China felt like, that was not a good thing for somebody to say, even if we kind of think it deep in our hearts, wherever it is that we think, in our brains, our hearts, whatever, that's not the kind of thing that we should be expressing. That does not sound good, and it's not the impression we want to be making to the world. I want China to care about the impression they're making on the world. You know, we want China to care about how the Europeans feel about them. That's a good thing. Whatever they're actually thinking, that they feel that they have a stake in appearing to be good citizens, is not quite as good as being a good citizen, but it's sort of halfway there. You know, it's the hypocrisy is the homage vice pays to virtue or whatever. I thought it was good that the call happened, both for that reason, insofar as it shows that they're sensitive to that set of kind of criticism, but also just that, you know, keeping those communication channels open, Ed is absolutely right. China is probably the only country that would be capable of gently, in a face-saving way, pushing Putin to make some concessions if necessary. It's not, obviously, China's not there yet, but might they get there at some point in, you know, 3 months, 6 months, a year? Maybe so. So, you know, all in all, I thought it was could it have been better? Could it have consisted of Xi saying to Zelensky, I am so sorry about the boorish behavior of those Russians. I'm going to have a word with them and fix this. That would have been nice. That didn't happen, of course, but I don't think anybody, I think as it was about as good as realistically we could have expected.
Corey, you know, Rosa said things don't happen in real life as fast as they do in TV or movies. But I have to say, the speed with which China has gone from kind of on the sidelines of international diplomacy to getting involved everywhere all the time, even though they're not doing a great job of it, you know, as the reference to the Chinese ambassador to France story goes. They're, you know, everywhere. They're in the Middle East. They're in Africa. They're in Latin America. They're now getting involved in Ukraine. Xi is going off and meeting with different people in different places all the time. You know, he's got one of these systems where he's got a couple of foreign ministers, right? He's got a vice premier and a foreign minister, and they're all out there all the time. I don't think that trend is going to change. I think China as an active international diplomacy player is something new. Do you?
Yeah, I think that's right, David. And as both you and Rosa pointed out, they're not very good at it in lots of instances. The thing I loved about the French at the Chinese ambassador to France's comments is that it means Russia is also not a internationally recognized state because they are a post-Soviet state as well. And so we should have put a little topspin on the ball with that one, which takes me to my broader point, which is that, you know, China's not very graceful as an international actor, and they don't, in most instances, have a very good story to tell other than to other repressive governments. And yet we are leaving them so much room to pick up easy wins because we are not doing more. And let me just give you the example that makes me levitate out of my chair, especially for an administration that claims it's putting diplomacy first, and it's not going to lead with military, with the military in American foreign policy. Every single month, the Secretary of Defense goes to Germany and gathers 50 of his counterparts to talk to the Ukrainians about what they need and figure out how to get it to them. Why isn't the Secretary of State pointedly, visibly, once a month, getting 50 counterparties together to talk about the peace that will eventually have to come in the war of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and build the international support for the outcome that we want? That actually doesn't cost us anything, and it's good diplomacy. And I don't know what Secretary Blinken's doing, but it's not that.
Well, he seems to be busy doing a lot of other things, but you're absolutely right, Corey. Finish the job, four more years. Anyway, that was Joe Biden's point earlier this week, and I'm going to get to that later. Another thing that happened, Ed, however, is just happening as we're recording this, but don't tell anybody, is that the president of South Korea has visited Washington. This is clearly part of a big push on the part of the White House, the ongoing push to shift things towards the Asia-Pacific region, strengthen our core alliances in that part of the world. Interesting development, one of the few that I've picked up so far, was in the press conference. The South Korean president said that should North Korea attack South Korea with nuclear weapons, not only would South Korea respond, but the U.S. would respond with nuclear weapons, which is something I don't think I've heard from a South Korean president before. Wondering why it should the average person sitting at home pay any attention to the fact that the president of South Korea and the president of the United States are meeting?
Yeah, South Korea becomes more and more important as time goes on, not just because it's a more a larger economy, a very successful economy than it used to be, but because of the neighborhood it's in. It's stymied by the existence of North Korea, the sort of rogue ward of China. But it has also, until recently, been heavily stymied by the bitter legacy of Japanese-Korean relations from the first half of the 20th century, the colonization of Korean Peninsula by Japan, the comfort women. And that sort of prevented Korea and Japan, South Korea and Japan, from being allies on the same page for the United States. They've now pretty much put that behind them. Japan has really turned a corner. It's getting much more geopolitical. It's getting much more pragmatic. And those sort of historic nationalist resentments seem to be giving way to a sort of clearer-eyed view of what threats they face in common. And of course, China is first and foremost, along with North Korea, on that list. So South Korea is getting more important treatment for good reasons in Washington nowadays. Its president Yoon Suk Yeol is a more nationalistic. He's more right wing than his predecessor. He's going to be more ebullient. This isn't a surprise. He's going to speak the language of fire with North Korea. Whether that has any impact on North Korea, I don't know, but it will probably have an impact on how China seeks to influence North Korea, because the last thing China wants is a distraction, some kind of a military escalation on the Korean Peninsula. The only other thing, which is a very important other thing to mention about South Korea, is that it's a major semiconductor producer. It looks like China is going to ban Micron, a big American semiconductor producer, from operations in China or restrict them. And the South Koreans want to come in and fill the gap, Samsung and other companies. Question is, does America allow that to keep South Korea happy, but enable China to keep importing dual-use technology, or does it play hardball? And I think it's going to be the former. I think the US is going to be accommodating with countries like South Korea because they're so very important to the broader alliance in a context of competition, great power competition with China.
That's an interesting and a complicated note. I love it also when you say things like speak the language of fire. You know, that's...
And refer to that as ebulliency.
Yeah, no, that's definite ebulliency. Now, Rosa, as the parent of teenage girls, presumably you view this all through the lens of BTS? No?
No.
Do you know BTS? Rosa?
No.
What's BTS?
What's BTS?
Oh, Jesus Christ.
David, is this one of those teenage things that only teenage girls and you know about?
That's good. That's
David, we're gonna cross examine you.
Wow, that's very hurtful and is likely to get me like
no.
Banned in the state of North Dakota.
It implies coolness.
It implies coolness, David. Take it for the win.
Yeah, I'm gonna take okay.
Take it for the win.
Well, what do you think about South Korea's president's visit, Rosa?
Just switch app things or companies with that does some kind of little app type thing.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Anyway, what do I think about South Korea? I think it's a nice country. I think their food is excellent. I don't know that. I mean, you started off asking Ed, is this something that the average American, you know, needs to be paying attention to? I'm not sure that they do, insofar as I don't actually think there's any new news here, although to some extent, the media is doing their best to make it seem like there's new news here. It's not, as far as I can tell, there really isn't anything new and different that has just happened or is about to happen. I think you're right. You know, we need South Korea. We need South Korea more and more. It's becoming of increasing strategic and economic importance. But not, you know, letting South Korean companies take some market share from U.S. chip makers is not the end of the world for us. I don't know how that one is going to play out. Actually, it sounds like the South Koreans are making noises suggesting that they're willing to be flexible on that, actually. So who knows? But I don't think there's been any significant shift happening here. And I don't take the ebullient statements to actually suggest anything significantly new.
Well, you got to say one thing, Corey, and that is, at least Joe Biden is like wooing the president of South Korea rather than the president of North Korea. That's a plus. That's a step forward.
That's a welcome change from the Trump administration. I agree.
Yeah.
And he is also not threatening a bloody nose preemptive strike on North Korea, which did damage to the U.S.-South Korean relationship. I mean, I do think that South Korea under its previous president was the first American ally to start noticeably hedging against American reliability during the Trump administration. So I'm delighted to see Rosa's conclusion that there's no news here. It's boring, satisfying international diplomacy with our friends. And that is, I wish I had a good answer to the threats North Korea poses, but I don't. And therefore, I can't come up with a better approach than what the Biden administration, before it the Obama administration, and before it the Bush administration had, which is, let's try and ignore them and hope they don't do anything really crazy. The only thing I wish we would add to that is the repeated statement, public and private, that if North Korea uses any of its weapons, nuclear or non-nuclear, against the U.S. or its allies, the North Korean leadership will not survive.
Well, you know, one of our friends is not here right now, David Sanger, I assumed was off having a three-martini lunch, but he has just posted about an hour ago, a story on the New York Times saying
things are not inconsistent.
No, that's true. And they're not mutually exclusive by any means. U.S. and South Korea agree to cooperate on nuclear weapons. It begins, the United States will give South Korea a central role for the first time in strategic planning for the use of nuclear weapons in any conflict with North Korea in return for an agreement that Seoul will not pursue its own nuclear weapons arsenal. Both sides are calling this a big breakthrough. Probably not as big a breakthrough as all that, but on the other hand, not a bad thing. Progress, and as Cordy says, kind of day-to-day diplomacy you like to see, because the best diplomacy is boring and doesn't make headlines and doesn't involve the ambassador and her husband sniffing each other's armpits either. For fans,
I could have gone so long without that visual, David.
Well, then or don't.
Our beginning of our discussion about the show diplomacy.
The diplomat. Just don't watch the show, The Diplomat, Corey, or you will actually have that image.
How do you know that it doesn't involve at some point off the record armpit sniffing?
No, you know, you're excellent.
Come on, kind of diplomatic
ritual. But you have to be an ambassador to know about it.
Yeah, that's true.
Cynical journalists.
Yeah, it's all on a need.
It's a closely kept secret.
It's all on a need to knows basis. All right. This is the point where we usually say to the public, hey.
It's really time to stop this podcast. Right.
We say to the public, hey, thanks for tuning in. And from here on in, there will be no more jokes like that, but that's only for our members. So for the general public, bye-bye. For the members, we'll get to the tasteful, but nonetheless hard-hitting last 10 minutes of the podcast right after this short break. So we're back, and I would like to now have a discussion about foreign policy that sounds like it's about politics, but it's not. Yesterday, Joe Biden, 6 o'clock in the morning, put up a 3-minute video announcing he was running again for president, full of pictures of his vice president, very stirring, gave a speech yesterday to a union, very stirring. Ed Luce wrote a kind of downbeat article about his prospects in the Financial Times, which, frankly, those of us who closely follow Ed's columns see as a good sign for Biden. Off we are. It looks like his opponent might be Donald Trump. What I'd like each of you to talk about is how this is going to affect the next year and a half of U.S. diplomacy. Because, for example, Russia clearly has an interest installing to see what happens in the election, because a Trump visit win would be very different for them with regard to Ukraine than a Biden win. Do other countries, do the Saudis, do the Iranians, do the Israelis, do the Chinese, does Kim Jong-un, how does the fact of a contested U.S. election that looks like it might be close affect international relations for the next year and a half, starting with you, Ed?
It's a really good question. Clearly the most important change that would happen globally and pretty much instantly with a Trump victory would be in Putin's head, and therefore in Ukraine's dramatically curtailed prospects. Trump promises to solve that within 24 hours. He can't contain his admiration for Putin. And notwithstanding the fact that Trump and Putin have lost Tucker Carlson's presence on Fox News as the reliable pro-Russia nationalist, there is a rising tide of, Putin philia in the MAGA ranks. So that's clearly the most important. On China, Trump's funny on China because, ostensibly the Republican Party as a whole, including MAGA, is more hawkish on China than the Democratic Party. But Trump himself's a wild card, as, you were referring to with Kim Jong-un. And, he can admire strong men, and he obviously likes Xi Jinping. And yet obviously blames, China for half of America's or more than half of America's problems. So China's a little bit more difficult to calculate than were it any other Republican. on the ticket next year, in which case I would say, well, it'll be the same policy, but more hawkish as Biden's been pursuing. More generally, a Trump presidency will cause that kind of hedging amongst allies, the prospect of it, even if it's a 1 in 3, 1 in 4, which is roughly what I'd give it. They know this is a game of Russian roulette, and sometimes the real bullet goes off. And if that real bullet goes off, you've got to hedge for it. You've got to take precautions, because it would not be an ordinary, change, even by Trump standards. This would be extraordinary to have him in a second term saying, I'm just leaving NATO. The capriciousness would be out of control, I think, and the sense of vindication would be out of control. So they've got a hedge against the possibility America goes errant again, goes sort of super aberrant again. And that's going to make countries cautious about the kind of conversations and long-term planning discussions they have with their American counterparts.
Rosa, Ed brings up the Europeans. If you're a European, Macron will say, see, I told you so. We need strategic autonomy. On another of our podcasts last week, somebody brought up the prospect of all this being led by Secretary of State Rudy Giuliani, which is, a little chilling.
Don't say that.
Little chilling. But, it could be Secretary of State Rick Grenell. So, the possibilities are endless. In any event, if you're an ally, you must look at this, particularly NATO ally, and be a little unsettled and want to get as much done as you could in the next 18 months. Is that what you do?
Yeah, as much done that's hard to undo that you can do. I mean, unfortunately, as we've seen, one president can come in and do a lot of undoing pretty rapidly. So nothing is, it's very, very hard to lock things in. And I think that's part of actually also what makes our allies and partners nervous, is that they know that even if they can get something done in the next 18 months, if God forbid Donald Trump becomes president for a second term, it can just be undone very rapidly. So I actually think sure, they'll still try to get things done, but they'll be very cautious, and they're right to be. I mean, Macron is a little twit, if I may say so. But he's not wrong, right? I mean, any sensible leader of any country that is an ally or partner of the United States has to be thinking and should be thinking for their own country's sake. What are the alternatives to the U.S.? How do we strengthen ourselves in the event that the U.S. goes rogue again? Because that could happen. And that's different from sort of saying, oh, who cares about the U.S.? We don't care about them anymore. And we're going to just go cuddle up with China, which I don't think is very cool. But at the same time, they should, and actually we should want our allies to be, provided it's not cozying up with our adversaries, we should actually want them to be trying to strengthen their own alliances and so forth, because we're going to need, we're going to need a strong and united Europe if Donald Trump becomes president next time, to keep him from doing too much damage. We're going to need our allies and partners to be in good shape and to be in a position to stand up to the United States if we go rogue, in terms of our White House going rogue. I don't think all of us are going to go rogue, but the White House might. As we saw last time, we ended up seeing under Donald Trump, we ended up seeing the White House that appeared to be frequently pursuing a foreign policy that was totally distinct from the foreign policy being pursued even by its own State Department, its own Pentagon, the intelligence community, et cetera. And I think we would see something like that again. And our allies are quite right to be concerned.
So, Corey, again, I don't want to talk about U.S. politics. If you're a foreign leader, how do you plan for this? It used to be for a long time, U.S. presidents were more or less, going to be within a few degrees one direction or another of each other. Now we seem to be in a period where they've got to sort of take a deep breath as they look to the next election. How does that change the way they behave, or does it?
Yeah, I think for the countries that are our closest friends and also our greatest contributors to common efforts, that is our European allies, Japan, Australia, South Korea, it's going to be really nerve-wracking if President Trump is reelected. America's frenemies, the countries of the Gulf, in some instances, this government of Israel, are going to be thrilled because the casino will be open. And that means the countries that make it more difficult for the sustainment of a liberal international order are going to be empowered, and they're going to be making choices and taking actions in expectation that the erratic but sympathetic American president can help them. And woe betide Ukraine if they haven't won their war before that eventuality. Because I do think Russia would already have succeeded in Ukraine if Donald Trump had been president instead of Joe Biden.
No question that that's the case. Anyway, I just
we would have been sending weapons to Putin to help.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can I say one other thing, David?
Of course.
Which is that one thing I would be doing if I were an American ally is spending a lot of time with the congressional leadership, because to the extent that Congress exercises its constitutional authorities, they have a lot of ability to shield friends from autonomous presidential action. And we saw that even during the Trump administration, where the Congress on a bipartisan basis denied him the money to remove troops from Germany, Japan, or South Korea. And I think we will all be looking to encourage that kind of activity in the dangerous circumstance if my fellow Republicans renominate Donald Trump for the presidency and if he should win.
Excellent point. It's why all world leaders should listen to DSR. And if you're not a world leader, but you're a friend of a world leader, recommend this episode to them because they need this kind of advice. For us, we'll continue to give it, solicited or not, on an ongoing basis, as we have been doing for many, many years now. And the reason we've been able to do it for many years now is that you guys out there are the best audience ever. Definitely the best audience ever, growing all the time, I might add. And because you like Rosa Brooks, Corey Shockey, Ed Luce, the absent David Sanger, and all other friends so much. So thank you, Rosa, Corey, and Ed. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back again soon with more fun stuff and fewer TV and movie reviews, probably. Bye-bye.